26, so I have to see something matching this. All of these of us. Figure out what K is. Well, K times V1, we recognize as just the derivative of V1 with respect to the radial distance. So this is the potential. If you take the derivative of the potential, you get the force. So this is the radial force. Apart from the minus sign.
Or any I, the radial force is actually an I there because it has this differentiated cosine and minus sign.
Okay. But as far, so that's the radial force. So as far as its amplitude is concerned, it is, in our previous notation,
this is where the Vanderhals interview continues, but the first part is garbled. But stick with it, and eventually it'll get straightened out.
So it's continuing with Vanderhals on 26-23. Right. So, recreation.
So, let's say,
And these people were from all over. And the article that's finally written, was that
shortly after
you gave the colloquium, and then it could not be published?
Until after the war.
Or did you?
Well, in fact, it must have been written almost immediately after the symposium, the normal slide to get it in a neat form.
Mm-hmm.
And publishing delay was not that much. I don't know.
It's summer 45, I think.
So here.
Okay, but it appeared summer 45. It seems that the print was gone home and prepared in the war.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because our war was only in May 45.
That's true. That's true. Well, what is the next step as far as radio astronomy? You got off into dust and things like that.
We had been in dust before that time. The first time we worked on the formation of dust and interstellar space. So we had preceded.
Right.
And I had to finish my thesis. I wanted to include one chapter on that dust, one chapter on the actual optics and speed computation, and that attended to my whole thesis.
Right, I see.
And then I got to Chicago to Yerkes, so Kuiper invited me over, postdoctoral fellow. Just after I finished my degree, went over.
What year is that?
46.
46.
Yeah.
Just about.
A year after the war, I finished.
So I guess you just missed being there with the discovery of the polarization.
I was already long back.
That's a shame that you missed that.
Yeah. Well, I did not miss much of it because by that time, from 46 to 48, I was with a fellowship at Yerkes Laboratory. And of course, I did a fair number of things there. And among other things, I did a good paper on light scattering planetary atmospheres, which I'm still interested now. And on the zodiacal lights, which is another piece of interest I did at that time. But not on radio astronomy. During that time, I remember only visiting Winter at his original place in Wheaton, Illinois, and also a fair number of discussions with Gruber and with Kuiper and with others on the possible funding of larger instrumentation by the American astronomers. But at that time, nobody was exactly certain how much there would be in it, how much of the investment would be warranted to go really full-fledged into radio astronomy. So now, of course, there were a few exceptions, like Cornell University, but the main astronomical community at that time was somewhat old enough. There are so many new things to be done. The entire infrared field was opening up with the lead sulfide cell, and there were a number of other
200 inches to start
important developments. So they certainly missed out on radio astronomy.
Right, in the States, America took a long while to catch up. Yeah. But of course, in the other countries, it wasn't the astronomers that got it going. It was radar labs and radio physics labs.
That is true for England and for Australia, but not true for Holland.
Not true for Holland, right? But then Holland didn't really come in until 5 years later after the war, also. I'm talking about the late 40s now.
Yes. Right. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Nothing much to boast of until the line.
But I'm interested, you say you talked with Struve and Kerker. I guess this was their attitude that you just described to me, that it looked interesting, but they weren't...
Oh, their attitude was it merits a close examination, but when you start a close examination, you reach a point where you must gamble, and that they did not do.
Right. And you said...
Or at least they took up a gamble.
Right. You say you visited Wheaton, Illinois too. Can you give me your impressions of what you saw there? Or of what Robert Reber impressed you at that time?
Well, a very jolly fellow, as he living there with his brother and his sister-in-law, I think, and how he's very much the man of who has a one big hobby in life, but he's not too serious about it. He wanted to clearly has big competence. He, for instance, was very proud on a number of small things. He was very proud that he put up the declination axis with a man from a neighboring garage rear axles.
I see.
And did a number of these things just all by himself. He was also very proud of his electronics, and one of his things, because I had no electronic knowledge at all, but one of the things he was proud about is that he, in various stages of amplification, he had side by side a number of these five-stage amplifiers, and each of them he could monitor the output to see if one stage went bad. That, at that time, was not at all standard practice. So he was really an artist in that type of work.
Was this with a meter?
With a meter, yes.
And then he had the one final strip chart, which he shows many examples of in his papers. Yeah. And so you say this was his whole life then, really? He spent almost all his free time?
That I never asked him, but the impression I got from others is that he really had some kind of a consulting job which he could take longer or shorter time, and then took a number of months off and then did this on his own account.
I see. Yeah. And what about, he went up to Chicago and took some courses, I understand, there, just to learn something about the astrophysics side. And of course, he was really the first one to propose the free flight. Just very briefly in the paper. But was he getting input from the astronomers as to what would be the next good thing to do? Or,
of course, by the time that these papers had been published, and that were already 38, the fact that they appear in the same journal together, the Reber observation and the Henley-Ankin interpretations, that already means that at that time a certain close tie had been made. That was long before I ever heard about it.
Right. But what I'm trying to get at is that the optical astronomers, he was listening to them more or less about...
Yes.
I mean,
It wasn't just a matter of reading some books and then doing it all by himself.
No. Yeah. Oh, and he actually had more time just after the war when everything started anew. He was actually playing propaganda for doing something bigger in radio astronomy.
Yeah, he wanted a 100-foot dish or something like that.
First bigger thing in what happened in America was this Cornell set up a Seagull and a Williamson.
Yeah.
That was a very nice start also.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you went to the States and you had some contact with radio astronomy there.
Yeah.
But you were not working directly in it.
No.
And then came back to Holland and what was going on when you cut back here in 48, I guess?
In 48, well, quite a number of things. One of the, I still had to finish part of a paper on this, on the interstellar dust. It's really that I did. That was this 49 papers, which I think it's published in 49, where the first somewhat more detailed calculation of the growth of dust and the expected composition later was called the dirty ice.
Right.
And at that time I had to learn the job of teaching and of doing things here at the observatory. And reading literature and keeping up to date and
but I was referring to what was going on in radio astronomy.
In radio astronomy at that time, at the they had already started a kind of a national committee which was not called for radio astronomy, but something for solar research or so, because it was obvious that some, well, as a source was something important, and Minard was interested in that. And Oort was also interested in it. And they had made it national in order to join forces. So there were several experts from the Post and Telegraph Service, and also a man from the Philips Laboratory, so in order to make sure that you had the right type of advice jointly rather than in competition. And this very first part, I have not been, I was a youngster, I have not been in there, but I think a year or 1.5 years later, this was changed into what's now called the Radio Astronomy Foundation. And there I have been a member from the beginning.
I see. So that was the forebearer of the Stichting.
Mm-hmm. No, it's the Stichting itself.
It was.
It's the Stichting itself.
Well, right, but that...
No, that earlier thing was the forebearer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, we had then already at that time, De Vogt had put this Woodward telescope in Kootwijk at the place where they had the radio receiver station of the PTT, mostly the links with Indonesia and so on. And so we had some free space there and sufficiently free hand to be able to do that. So we got from the Cameron Honors Laboratory, we got some electronic equipment and partly dump equipment. And there was a man who tried to get a receiver working, and it worked to some extent, but really not enough to get good signals.
Is this Ho?
That was Mr. Ho, yes. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, changed changed absolutely completely from the time that Muller came.
Yes.
And Muller was perhaps at that time already before he joined this Stichting, was the one man, or one of the very few men in Holland who knew anything at all about noise, electronic noise, because that was his subject on which he had done his major research work during his studies at Delft University.
But now, before Mueller came, were there any astronomical observations? Or was it just all not quite getting there?
I'm not entirely certain. I don't want to bet on that, but I would nothing to speak of.
Yeah, nothing was published there.
Yeah, nothing to speak of.
Yeah. And the aim was the sun, or was it?
No, the aim at that time was, of course, first of all, to do as well as Weber had done. I mean, that was a clear objective you could put yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then successively to do better. But it was absolutely clear from the computations that it should be possible to get the galaxy and to get the sun.
But working at rather short wavelengths for those times.
True, you're right, but in the beginning we were working on a number of wavelengths, you see. That is, I'm pretty certain that we started also out near 3 meter or 1.5 meter wavelength. Again, I would have to look that up in the old documents.
But then it got shorter.
Yeah. No, and then at that time, quite when another came, you first of all got the thing working, and from normal continuum work. And of course, at the same time, we started to construct equipment for the 21 centimeter, which for the present, technique, was called the technique of the time, was pretty the short wavelength.
So I see. So the continuum work was at much longer wavelength.
I'm absolutely certain because
the level that was done.
Because the Vogt had also indeed a hole in the ground covered with this wire mesh, which must have been working at that time. In 1.5 or 3 meters, I really don't know, but it can all. I think we can all reconstruct it if necessary.
Yeah, I'd like to see those reports. Yeah, see if we check those.
Yeah.
Okay, so when did the push for the line begin, or was it always in the back of everyone's mind?
It was not even in the back of the mind. We always. Knew that perhaps sooner or later it would be successful, and Miller was working for it, but he could not do everything at the same time. You first need a continuum receiver before you get a line receiver, and then in fact the actual trigger came when I spent a semester in early 1951 in Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And there we were with the three of us together, Kerr and Ewan and I, you see. And Ewan was a student of Purcell's. Apparently Purcell had gotten the idea entirely independently that this might be something to observe from the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think when he got the idea he knew about my paper, nor did Klosky know about my paper. So it was very much in the air, but it was also clear from our conversation in Harvard at that time that Muller did not know the newest tricks. Ewan did know about the switching back and forth between different frequencies. Ewan had been actually working on the cyclotron at Harvard and had all the newest electronic techniques in his recent experience. That gave him a certain head start.
Right.
But on the other hand, Ewan did not know enough astronomy to realize how wide this line would actually be. He was thinking in terms of a ridiculously short interval between the switching and the epitel, and then forget about it and take it wider because of the Doppler shifts.
Right.
So, and so there was a kind of certain amount of give and take and letter writing, and that to me explains why the actual time interval between the different observation, first observation, was not very long.
I see, and you were the facilitator, really.
Well, Kerr also did a lot of writing.
But he was writing with the Australians, presumably.
Yeah, right.
But of course, they also...
No, but we did it not often.
They came in very shortly after this.
I think I sometimes thought this is difficult for the type of cooperation you do get in those fields where the competition element doesn't count too strongly. Never think that an industry thing would go this way.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But now, so you were in the physics department, I guess.
I was in the physics
department. And he had never done any astronomy before.
No, but I mean, in a good university, you know about astronomy, you know where to find them. Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll have to try to. He's still alive. I mean, Purcell is still alive, isn't he?
Oh, yes, I mean, Purcell is very much alive. Yes.
I'm afraid I don't know. I'll have to try to talk to him about where he got the ideas.
Purcell has had several students and himself also working on, say, on interstellar grain orientation and so on. So
in the last few years?
In the last year.
Yeah. Okay, so you were actually away, but you went to Harvard, that had nothing to do with the line, though. That was just an accident that...
Yeah, I was asked to do a course there, and in fact, at that time, well, not entirely. I did choose as a subject radio astronomy, and I think that was the first course ever given on the world on that subject.
I have those notes. Yeah, I made a copy of them.
Yeah.
And you had you given that course before?
Yes, I had given just a semester before. I had given something similar at Leiden.
But nevertheless, you went to Harvard not knowing about this. You and Purcell experiment.
Yes, I learned about it a little before that time with, I think, via other VR physicists here. They came with a rumor which seemed all wrong, but it had part of the truth in it, and so inquired about somebody had visited Phillips and had told about somebody else doing something, and when we finally reconstructed it, it was this line.
I see. Okay, so... Were you back in Holland when the line was discovered, or was that?
No, I was still over there.
So, well, that's right. I heard how that happened, right?
Yeah.
You sent a telegram, and
yeah.
Kerr sent a telegram.
Yeah.
And
Actually, I was there at Harvard, and one time Ewan came into my office and unrolled one of his narrow strip charts.
Right.
4 inches wide and 5 inches wide, and rolled it over the floor and said, if you look along it with your eye, you can see the wiggle.
And that was the line, yeah.
That was the line, yeah.
And why didn't they follow up any? That's always puzzled me.
That's the crazy system of education, and that's quite a bit. Because here we teach the languages when you need them before you study. But there they wanted to have a language requirement by the time you get your
degree. Your degree, right.
So I know that you vanished for a month to Poughkeepsie to study German words.
I see. But that still doesn't explain why they didn't follow up in the long term.
You wouldn't actually later found that a private company, like so many people do, the UN Knight Corporation,
right.
And it was, I don't know how successful he was from a business end, but certainly that he made quite a few of the early receivers for radio astronomy.
Right.
And so that was his way of following up.
Well, that's true. He did contribute the receivers for Agassiz, didn't
yeah.
he? Yeah.
And I mean, Box Star was there at Harvard, from which later many of the big names in radio, in American radio astronomy have come.
That's right. Yeah.
Like Dave Eachin, for instance.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of
that. That was possible only, I mean, because of the good cooperation with you and you see. So there is a follow up.
Yeah, that's true.
Only a little delayed.
That's true. Right, so you came back to Holland and then you got involved in, I would think, in the analysis of the von der Holst, Mueller and Oort paper.
Yes. I hesitate to say whether that was my main work at that time, you see. I don't remember too well whether what I did mainly.
Can I switch the light on, please?
Yes, you want to.
Just want to make sure it's turning around.
Yeah, okay.
You see, one of the things I was very heavily involved also in 49, you mentioned the colorization of a status. At that time, I did, together with Burgers, the editing of that, and first the preparation and later the editing of that first cosmical aerodynamics symposium,
which
was an enormous job, but certainly the way Burgers wanted to do that, and it was at that time still relatively new to do a symposium so completely with discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the feeling that that took much more of my input than the practical age astronomy. Because eventually these things get together somewhere.
Right. But what was your interest in? I mean, you hadn't worked in galactic structure and so forth before. But,
no.
How did you get involved?
Well, I got, of course, very much interested. Of course, I kept very much up to date, and I did a fair amount of the practical work, the helping out in practical arrangements myself. And in fact, in 1953, 2 years later, we were so far that we could actually make a first map of spiral arms, and that had to be ready for a meeting in April. And
which
we spent at that time, as you get, during the Christmas vacation, we spent with virtually everybody at the observatory several days in the lecture room reading off these long rolls of paper and plotting them on a uniform scale. And that is that set of profiles which is in these older papers.
Yeah, Hart Westerhout has told me about herding everyone into the room.
Yeah, right. And in fact, I must still have somewhere a couple of them still have the original profile. Because it's set in this room with one of these desk lamps under a plate of glass copy them, and late at night still, all on the same scale in order to be able to use them the next day in a lecture.
But now, when was this? This was mainly for a meeting that you were trying to...
Well, it was for three meetings. There was a special meeting of the Academy of Sciences, one of those decentralized meetings was actually in Drenthe, not in Dringelo, but...
Yeah.
And where I had been asked to give a review, and so this results ought to be included, and then there was a meeting of the National Academy in Washington.
And it was in 1954.
And there was in 1953, and there was a meeting, I gave the Halley Lecture in Oxford also. That all went...
That's right, that's in an observatory.
Yeah, that was all went all in succession in the same month, essentially. So those fresh results were being used for that.
That's right, and the Halley Lecture is published in the Observatory.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
So, well, that paper was published in 1954, and that, of course, I think, even up till now, is sort of the basic paper for the structure of the galaxy. I mean, that sort of established it. It's been done later in a lot more detail, but
yeah.
But the methods are still basically the same. And
well, of course, it's not quite an action. If you know that, of course, Ortsch sees his loss on the differential rotation.
Right.
And it was obvious that Ortsch would be the first of anybody to realize when you had a line in the radio domain, you could get out of the linearized portion of that thing and get everything.
Right. Yeah, that's right, it's more accent. Well, let's see. Where does it take us next? What is the next step in your involvement in radio astronomy?
Well, of course, then, already at that time, we were much earlier, we were heavily planning for a really big telescope, really big, 25 meters.
Right.
And so that planning took a fair while, but that was well underway, the construction was well underway already in the years we talk about, because it was opened in 55 or 56. And that took endless meetings, endless discussions also, and one of the discussions I remember vividly was whether the investment was justified in view of the fact that perhaps after mapping the sky we would have nothing else to do.
You already done it all, you mean?
Yes. If there was only continual radiation and only to a certain sensitivity, then of course you could perhaps map the sky and so on. But that we soon convinced ourselves and others that other things were likely to follow, and there were many frequencies, and there were possibly a line, and all these things together gave it already in 49 the conviction that it was fully justified to ask for a big telescope.
But it's interesting, there was doubt in your mind as to whether to...
It was. I think if you... Well, I don't know if that discussion has been recorded, but if the minutes of our meetings would be complete, then you could probably find that discussion back.
Yeah. So your next involvement was with the Twinkalo data, next to the radio astronomy, and that was, I guess, M31?
The one thing where I was personally very strongly involved, but I was often very strongly involved in helping and suggesting work for students and so on, but where I was personally strongly involved with the M31, yes, it's with Enstremont. And again, I remember that I did two things. I did make a computation beforehand of what might be expected, quantitative. It was turned out to be correct on the dots. If I remember well, of a 7-degree maximum brightness temperature. But then also it took me some persuasion at Twinkalo to actually go after it, because several people had tried on runs and nothing visible came, nothing clearly visible came. So on the basis of that calculation, I convinced them, let's do something very unorthodox and really sit for 50 minutes on one spot. 50 minutes somewhere else, and 50 minutes back. And when we did that, then it came out.
Really integrate, yeah.
Really integrate. At that time, for some, to do something for 50 minutes instead of something of the order of 1 minute was...
Everything was sort of drift scans before then, wasn't it?
Was mostly drift scans, yeah.
Yeah.
That was quite unconventional, and of course that was only possible. And I'll say, do as if it was my idea. This was made possible only because Muller had made such a good receiver.
Such a stable receiver.
Yeah. And that was absolutely clear, but it was also clear to me that having such a stable receiver, one should go to the bottom of it and try to use it in this way. And then, if you remember in that paper, we then used that method from all these points and got a very nice record out of it.
Right. And that's... Well, besides from the Magellanic Clouds, that was the second extended extragalactic object.
Yeah.
Harvard had picked up a few galaxies they couldn't resolve. But,
right.
And would you say that changed any ideas about the nature of galaxies? or spiral?
No. Parallel to this is the first development of, you say, the non-thermal radio astronomy.
Really,
that started already immediately at 46 with the discovery of the first point sources of Cygnus and Cassiopeia A.
Right.
And that line, you can also, I've been vividly involved with that, but I have not done nothing specific about it.
Yeah.
It was clear that in all of the work, with the early work with Ringer, of course, we picked up those brighter galaxies and we actually stopped the construction of the Ringer telescope at the occasion of the first, one of the first occultations of the Kepler Nebula by the moon.
Westerhout told me about that. Yeah.
And so we were very much aware of that other side, we could not do everything at the same time. So we, but from the so the excitement certainly was in those, was also in those distant nebulae.
Right, but no, I'm asking, I mean, M31 we think is sort of like our own galaxy in some respects. And, was there, what do you think were the additional things that were learned from the Twinkle, or was it observations, or was it pretty much as you expected?
No, it was a surprise in M31 that the hydrogen extended so far out. And it also was a relatively empty near the nucleus. Of course, Hart had in his thesis on the two regions something similar, but it was not quite clear that we would. This was different.
This was true in H1, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And that we could not, with any certainty, see from our own galaxy.
Right.
No, I would characterize that as a nice result, but it was the first neutral hydrogen from outside our own galaxy, but it was not...
The Magellanic Clouds.
That may have been first earlier, right. But it was not anything which is... which, so to say, was terribly exciting.
Right, didn't overturn, no.
But of course, you always have to follow those two lines. Some things which are which are too novel might not link up with anything, and this linked up so strongly with other things that you could say it's hardly anything new.
It's a natural extension.
Yeah, to do that, and I must also confess that I personally tend to stay a little the conservative side. Things that do link up rather than speculate.
Mm. Well, we need both kinds. Well, let's see now. Is it starting about 60 or so? You got very much involved in space research, didn't you? Or is it more radio astronomy that you directly worked in after the M31?
No, I don't think so.
Except, like I say, you've been a member of the board of the Stick Team.
I'm a member, and of course, now, more important is that I've been a professor at Leiden Observatory, and so there have been thousands of discussions of what to do, or what not to do, what to propose, what not to propose. And also, although my official duty here was to teach theoretical astrophysics, we have more or less on purpose neglected the theoretical end of it, in order to be able to man the observing staff for this type of work.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I have theoretical astrophysics has remained a little underdeveloped in Leiden since that time, because you have to put a certain priority.
Right. Yeah, so you've been involved in the whole development of Western work and so forth. So But I talked to a few other people about that.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you think of that you might want to know?
How much time? You can't set the fair or anything. Well, we
only thing I could give you for the invitation. Of course,
right, I'd like to see that.
For the rest,
okay, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Hank Vonderholst on 26 November 73. This is also the end of this side of the tape.